today on EdgeFX.
One cannot responsibly, I believe, remain just within a literary realm and do this kind of criticism well. And that's a tribute to these poets, I think, in terms of their engagement in the world that we live in.
Sarah Thomas, literary studies scholar and member of the EdgeFX editorial board, speaks with Lynn Keller, the Martha Mayer-ranked Bascom Professor of Poetry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the director of the Center for Culture, History, and Environment. An award-winning teacher and recent Guggenheim Fellow, Lynn Keller has written 4 books and numerous articles on contemporary poetry. In the conversation that follows, Lynn Keller traces how poets have responded to the new environmental awareness sparked by debates about the Anthropocene, and how our growing self-consciousness about human impacts on the planet has wide-ranging implications. And they discuss her most recent book, Recomposing Eco-Poetics, North American Poetry of the Self-Conscious Anthropocene. Published in 2018 by the University of Virginia Press, it's the first book devoted exclusively to the eco-poetics of the 21st century.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the EdgeFX podcast.
Thanks.
Yeah, we're really, really glad to be talking about your new book with you. And so I'll jump right in. Your book, Recomposing Eco-Poetics, uses some central terms that I think might be helpful for our listeners to kind of unpack a little bit. And because you're looking at eco-poetry, or what some people might understand as nature poetry, be familiar with poets like William Wordsworth or Ralph Waldo Emerson or even Mary Oliver, instead you take up with a very different group of contemporary writers, poets who you say, quote, create poems that are more analogous to landfills scavenged by gulls or city boulevards awash in diesel fumes, end quote. So could you tell us why you've chosen to focus on eco-poetics, what that term means? And then could you help us understand how eco-poetics can move us productively past the tradition of nature poetry?
Sure. So actually that quote that you read was, it was more analogous to those things than something that Jonathan Bate said in a wonderful study called Song of the Earth, which he characterized as an experiment in eco-poetics. And he was regarding poems, or proposing that you regard the poems he was studying as imaginary parks in which we may breathe an air that is not toxic and accommodate ourselves to a mode of dwelling that is not alienated. So that was a quote from him. And that's sort of the vision of nature poetry that I want to expand us beyond. I have no desire to denigrate nature poetry and the kinds of resources that it offers people, but it is a very narrowly construed category. And there is so much writing now, poetry being composed, that goes beyond the parameters of nature poetry. Nature poetry being associated, I think, with the kind of the solitary individual in a natural, like a wilderness or rural setting, finding consolation in the beauties of nature, that kind of thing. And the poets that I'm writing about, who are all 21st century poets, and the books that I focus on are all published in the 21st century, are interested in looking much more about how nature and culture are imbricated and work together, are really inseparable. And in thinking about the ways in which, well, let me read you a little passage from one of the poets that I work on named Juliana Spahr. And this is from her book, Well Then, There Now. She spent a few years living in Hawaii, and some of her work comes out of that experience. And she says in this book, "Shortly after I moved to Hawaii, I began to loudly and hubristically proclaim whenever I could that nature poetry was immoral. There's a lot of nature poetry about Hawaii. Much of it is written by those who vacation here, and it's often full of errors. Rob Wilson calls these poems 747 poems. These poems often show up in the New Yorker or various other established journals. But I was more suspicious of nature poetry because even when it got the birds and the plants and the animals right, it tended to show the beautiful bird, not so often the bulldozer off to the side, that was destroying the bird's habitat. And it wasn't talking about how the bird, often a bird which had arrived recently from somewhere else, that is an introduced species, interacted with and changed the larger system of this small part of the world we live in and on. So I think this is one example mm-hmm. of a poet expressing a desire to think of poetry as a more capacious genre mm-hmm. that can go beyond thinking just about the position of the person wandering in the wilderness or looking out their suburban window mm-hmm. at the beautiful birds or whatever, and to confront the environmental problems that we face and to allow poetry to be a more intellectual genre mm-hmm. without sacrificing its emotional depth, but to allow lots of kinds of information and lots of issues into the work itself. So the term ecopoetics is, there's not really one definition mm-hmm. of what that is, but it is understood broadly, I think, as a more inclusive category than just nature poetry. And I guess the other thing I would add is that when the sort of the eco-criticism, the literary criticism that we have that considers work through environmental lenses, its considerations of poetry have been pretty narrow. And they have focused on that nature poetry tradition. So one of the purposes of my book is to introduce those readers, people who are interested in reading literature about the environment, to a whole range of poets who are doing things that go beyond nature poetry.
Yes, thank you. That definitely comes across in reading your book. And it suggests to me that there's a real way that eco-poetry can contribute something to environmentalism, something new.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. A lot of this work is exploratory. It's not that the poets feel like they've got the answers, mm-hmm. But that desire to bring in the resources of a variety of disciplines, the mm-hmm. scientific knowledge, psychological understanding, sociological analysis, financial analysis, our economic analysis, to bring those things into poetry that is exploring our relation to, you know, sort of the human and cultural, natural mm-hmm. complex is really a rich thing to be exploring. Yeah.
Yeah, and that interdisciplinarity comes across in the way that you theorize one of the central terms of your book, which is the self-conscious Anthropocene. And I imagine some listeners will be familiar with the discourse of the Anthropocene as a proposed geological epoch, but you describe it as something that these poets use self-consciously. Could you explain that?
Yeah, actually the term self-conscious Anthropocene, which I do coin here and hope will be useful. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping it'll be useful more broadly than just thinking about poetry. So with the Anthropocene, of course, this was a term proposed initially by several scientists, and they were making a call largely to other scientists to recognize the many ways in which the human is transforming the planet. And then subsequently, there have been all these debates among geologists. When did it start, right? Mm-hmm. And if we're going to make it officially an epoch, where do we locate the beginning? Where's the golden spike and so forth? And those are very interesting and important discussions. But I think I wanted to step aside from those mm-hmm. considerations and look at the cultural ramifications of an awareness. So the term Anthropocene was coined by Crutzen and Sturmer or it became public in 2000. And I use that as a marker for the beginning of what I'm calling the self-conscious Anthropocene, which is a period when people in the developed world, at least, are very conscious of the impact of the human and anxious, often anxiously mm-hmm. so. I'm trying to sidestep the debates about mm-hmm. when the Anthropocene itself begins and call attention to the now pervasive awareness that we are in a big environmental mess. And these poets are responding to that. And I think many more parts of our society are responding to that than just poets. So I am mm-hmm. hoping, as I say, that this notion of the self-conscious Anthropocene as a cultural phenomenon can be more broadly useful.
Yes, yes. And you do diagnose that kind of moment that we're in right now that is something self-conscious. One of the challenges of thinking about the Anthropocene is thinking about geologic time and our human place in that. What poetry might offer to these perceptual problems right. of the Anthropocene.
Right, yeah. So the book itself has some chapters that are about poets responding to specific issues, mm-hmm. such as the proliferation of plastics in our environment. I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about that. But some of the chapters are about more the conceptual challenges that the self-conscious Anthropocene mm-hmm. poses for us. And scale is mm-hmm. certainly one of those, thinking about the human as both way off scale in a huge mm-hmm. way in terms of its impact, and yet so pathetically tiny in geological time or mm-hmm. in real sort of geological significance as a species, right? The planet doesn't care if we mm-hmm. exist or not. And so I think what poets can offer is, as always, a kind of, I think I'll probably keep returning to this word, capacious response and way of thinking mm-hmm. about these issues. So that, well, I quoted from Juliana Spahr's mm-hmm. work earlier, and one of the works that she has in that book, Well Then There Now, is called Unnamed Dragonfly Species. Mm-hmm. And it's a meditation on human responses to climate change that also, and the kind of psychological difficulty of someone who is not necessarily close to the most immediate effects of climate change, someone not living on an island watching the seas rise, but instead watching on the internet the glacial melt and knowing that that has significance, huge significance, and not knowing quite how to process that and how to deal with our sense of individual smallness in the scale of these changes, our sense of individual helplessness. And at the same time, running through that text are the names of threatened species in New York State. They come an individual name between each sentence of the text. So I think this way of kind of bringing together multiple issues or approaches into a single text mm-hmm. is one of the things that a poet can do. A scientist can only write up his or her research data. And whereas a poet can read that scientific work, think about his or her own experience, interview people, read in other fields, bring in a lot of different mm-hmm. kinds of material to try to convey the complexity of the kinds of issues that we face, but to do so in a way that's still intelligible and that generates a feelingful response in readers.
Yes, absolutely. We'll link to Juliana Spahr's collection for listeners. It's one that stands out for me as one of these texts that does that juxtaposition of like the very literary with the kind of pressure and pressing kind of concerns that we experience when we face environmental change, like the melting of the glaciers or the extinction of certain birds and other animals. And that should bring us to maybe talk about some of the other collections that you discuss in your book and maybe some other ways that poetry responds to environmental change. So as we start moving more into the book itself, I wanted to ask you about the kind of experimental nature of mm-hmm. some of the poets and the collections that you discuss, and how this form of writing poetry does something different than perhaps the lyric or other protest forms of poetry.
Okay, sure. So I would say actually that a lot of this work might be understood as protest work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends mm-hmm. on how you're defining mm-hmm. that term. Certainly, many of these poets feel passionately about the need for a change of direction in mm-hmm. our society and in global trends as well, and try to convey mm-hmm. that passion, I think. But the lyric tends to speak just from personal experience in sort of the American tradition of the personal lyric. It has become a kind of personal venue. Mm-hmm. That comes out of the Romantic tradition of the single speaker, often mm-hmm. in a natural setting, reflecting on private experience and also on environmental surroundings. But this kind of work, I think, tries to reflect in its forms more of the kinds of experience of the more complicated world. Mm-hmm. Let me read you a passage from One of the poets whose work I discuss is Forrest Gander. And like many of the poets that I treat, I discuss more than one of the books that they've produced. But this is a passage from a book called Red Start, an ecological poetics that's actually co-authored by Forrest Gander and the Australian poet John Kinsella, who's not a subject of the book. But I think it's characteristic that this passage is posed as a series of questions because these poets whose work is more experimental in form are engaged in exploration and interrogation and just trying things out in the hopes often that by pushing the boundaries of conventional language use, they are also pushing the boundaries of conventional ways of thinking and behaving, and that that will open new possibilities for us. Here is Forrest Gander is asking some questions about, can poetry be ecological? And it's just a passage of questions. Can it display or be invested with values that acknowledge the economy of interrelationship between human and non-human realms? Aside from issues of theme and reference, how might syntax, line break, or the shape of the poem on the page express an ecological ethic? So here he's getting into formal questions, right? So I'll go on with his questions. If our perceptual experience is mostly palimpsestic or endlessly juxtaposed and fragmented, if events rarely have discrete beginnings or endings, but only layers, duration, and transitions, if natural processes are already altered by and responsive to human observation, how does poetry register the complex interdependency that draws us into a dialogue with the world? So those are some questions that he poses, but I think this reminding us that our experience is mostly layered, juxtaposed, fragmented, without neat closure, and so forth, that this points to the kinds of formal experiments that these poets are conducting and their kind of resistance to a sense that neatly closed, kind of epiphanic document where a person alone in the woods has this beautiful experience and a kind of moment that feels revelatory and of great personal significance. And that can close the poem with a kind of resounding and uplifting moment. That doesn't suit their experience of the contemporary world. And it is that world that they want to register for us in a way that will make us more aware and more attentive to the realities we inhabit.
Yes, I love that. The nuance and the complexity is something that they sit with.
Right. Absolutely. To sit with it. And that can be sometimes messy. And there's a desire to embrace that messiness, sometimes in very hybrid forms. Sometimes in forms that really do violate conventions of syntax, and that is sentence structure, or other kinds of language conventions that keep us comfortable.
Right. So even the syntax should be, in a way, disorienting for readers
sometimes,
in order to to produce that effect.
Yeah.
That the world that we live in is messy.
And it's not arbitrary. I mean, I don't think they're just, I think that would be the poor versions of this work where it's arbitrary, but where it's really motivated as part of this really thoughtful interrogation of our experience.
Yes, yes. And that leads me to my next question, which is that none of the authors that you write about are take a similar approach. I mean, there's a variety of aesthetic choices that they're making, formal choices that they're making in their writing, even though they all fall under this capacious term of eco-poetics. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of these collections and how perhaps like Evelyn Riley, who's who's using chemical compounds and the structure of chemical compounds to talk about toxicity in her collection Styrofoam, or Angela Rawlings, who's using sonic play and even drawings and wide slumber for lepidopterists. And then you read that wonderful passage from Forrest Gander, but you know, I could go on. I could list everyone that's doing something visually striking or syntactically disorienting and compelling. But can you speak a little bit more about the variety of the collections and what it's like to write within the environmental humanities?
Yeah. So it's an adventure. And one of the things is that, and it's a privilege because my poets have taught me so much, mm-hmm. and that's been true throughout my career, not just when mm-hmm. I was working on eco-poetics, but that they lead me to read things and to teach myself about things that they have taught themselves about, right? So that if I'm writing about plastics, then I have to learn something mm-hmm. about plastics myself following these poets. And if I'm writing about animals, I have to learn about what's being said in animal studies or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there is a challenge, I think. One cannot responsibly, I believe, remain just within a literary realm mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and do this kind of criticism well. And that's a tribute to these poets, I think, mm-hmm. in terms of their engagement in the world that mm-hmm. we live in, so that they're not just engaged with the tradition of writers behind them, even though that's very important and it's very helpful for someone doing the kind of work I do to know mm-hmm. literary history mm-hmm. and to be able still to hear allusions to past writers or whatever. But you need much more than that. And you do need to be listening to what's happening in a range of disciplines. And I'm so fortunate to be here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where there are so many fabulous environmental scholars, and I can learn from them as well as from things that I read. But you're right that these poets are, the work is so diverse, mm-hmm. and many of them take advantage of page space to kind of use that as one of the resources that they have. And Evelyn Riley, I have a chapter on plastics, mm-hmm. and in that chapter, I focus on her volume, Styrofoam, and on another book about plastics by mm-hmm. a Canadian poet named Adam Dickinson, who has a book called The Polymers. Mm-hmm. And the two of them are differently interested in how plastic molecules work. For Dickinson, he's interested in the way in which polymeric forms are also social forms. The chains of plastics are echoed in our social interactions mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so forth. So some of his poems are directly about plastic pollution, and others of them are about chains of that appear in to his mind in human interaction. And both of these poets are very interested in the notion of plasticity and the way in which plasticity is a great virtue for the artist, and of course for human intellectual discovery, at the same time that plastics themselves, mm-hmm. plastic is a marvelously appealing material for an artist and for a scientist, and yet plastics are a source of terrible pollution right now, and to our water, especially mm-hmm. to our mm-hmm. land and to our bodies. The endocrine disruption mm-hmm. of plastics is of great concern to mm-hmm. both of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to read these works, you have to, you know, you are reading through scientific formula, and Dickinson does some very creative things with structuring his poems around chemical formulae and.
Yeah, and they're really wonderful to read because you're pushed intellectually to imagine what's beyond the page, but there's so much play on the pages of these collections that they're in a way delightful and terrifying.
Yes, uh-huh. mm-hmm. And both of those poets have a sense of humor mm-hmm. as well.
That's true,
Which is not a characteristic generally associated mm-hmm. with a personal lyric, for instance, mm-hmm. and they do bring that to bear. And of course, it's a helpful resource when you're dealing with such emotionally challenging issues. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the experimental forms of uh-huh. these collections. One way that you can notice the experimental work of these writers is on the visual arrangement of the words on the page, which may be just one way of tracing that.
Yes.
And there are others. And we'll certainly link to some of these on the website. Uh-huh. We can't show you the visual arrangement right here. But there are also poets who are working with sound and the sonic form of words and how that might orient us to their conceptual and formal experimental practices. So would you mind reading
Absolutely.
From one of these collections
that do
that?
Let me see if I can find. Maybe I'll even read you a couple different ones to give you a sense. You know, sound is just such an important resource for poets, right? And in this conversation, I really maybe haven't emphasized or even called attention to the fact that poets work with language, right? They love words. They love language and the many layers of suggestion that it's capable of, and the material word, what it feels like on the tongue, what it sounds like in the ear, and so forth. So that's never very far away, I think. One of the volumes that you mentioned, Wide Slumber for Lepidopterists by Angela Rawlings, who publishes as A. Rawlings. She does use visual, the page space, and she, an artist friend of hers has produced drawings that are part of this. Matt Kalin is his name. But the sound of the work is also just crucially important. So let me read you a passage from near the beginning of this book, which is a book that kind of blends the experience of butterflies or moths, Lepidoptera, with that of humans. So, here we go. We descend on a field by a lake. A whoosh. The lupin, sleep, the fog. Aha. Fireflies, silent moths. We bury our legs in sand. Sound through sand is dormant. We desire sleep to enter, virginal. We stretch our feelers toward the warm body. Ah, ah. Slowly, hands fog damp, spin plants, form air-filled hollows, breath cocooned, fur soft and blurred, heavy, even heavenly, whoosh, soft like quiet, ha, soft like we quiver. Slow, light touch of hand on wings, scales brush off like butterfly kisses, hand on brow, eyelash, dew and fog, breath and fur, our entrance, and we caress the dulled wet passage, the flicker of soft quiet like sand, sound or sand, when larva eats the eggshell and becomes pupa, a whoosh.
Oh, there's so much beautiful alliteration and breath work.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, larva eats eggshell and becomes pupa. We've got some, you know, we've got some scientific, I mean, basic, but information there that's also really important to, to the work. Let me read you another sample, maybe, to give you something quite different. This is going back to Forrest Gander. This is from that same book, Red Start. And this is from a poem called The Carboniferous and Ecopoetics. And what he does in the early sections of this poem is take us through the foundation of sort of all the coal that we're consuming by taking us back to the Carboniferous era and helping us imagine it. And as he does that, sound is tremendously important. So I'm just going to read you a little bit at the very beginning of that poem, where you're being drawn into the Carboniferous partly through sound. In one of the beginnings, below the fluff and leaf-encrusted surface of a wide, shallow body of water, microscopic spores swirl with bat-winged algae. A cloudy soup of exertions and excretions, the sea drizzles its grit into rich mud. Trilobites are dying off. Miles Davis could have been quoting nature when he said, "I listen to what I can leave out." Brachiopods, mollusks, and corals cluster in wide, shallow seas riven by sharks. Thick fish with lungs and lobes are giving way to a new species, the lung reconfigured as a swim bladder. Like surreal underwater candelabra, crinoids effloresce. On long branching stems, they stretch up toward the waves, each arm filtering small animals and plants through the calyx where a mouth is hidden.
Ooh.
So there's obviously much more to this, but that gives you a sample of another poet really using the sound of language to carry us into a world. This comes back, I think, to something of what we said about scale. How do we think back to an era where there were no humans and so forth? How do we imagine this time? And here's a poet taking us there, partly through just the sensory resources of our language.
Right. And the scientific work of our language to give name to these.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I love that these two collections that you've just read from bring us to the non-human world. But one of the important discussions around the Anthropocene is that the Anthropocene is not experienced evenly for all humans. And this is something that you discuss in your book. And so would you speak to that and how poets are dealing with that?
Yeah. So environmental justice issues are very important to a great many poets writing now. And in the book, I talk about three of them to just give some of the sense of diversity of kinds of writing. And One of them, Mark Nowak, works in a much more documentary mode. So that's one of the ways in which poets are helping with eco-justice awareness, I think, is by really carefully documenting situations. In the case of Mark Nowak's work, he was very interested in the book that I use called Coal Mountain Elementary. He's interested in coal mining disasters, and his focus is primarily human, but also on the natural environment as well. But then on the other hand, we have someone like Ed Roberson, an African-American poet who is thinking very much within an urban context about environmental justice issues that affect African-American people in particular in cities. Maybe I'll read you a little passage from one of Ed Roberson's poems from his collection called City Eclogue, a collection that right away kind of signals, you know, we think of the eclogue as a pastoral genre, and in the pastoral tradition, the city and the country are opposed, and the country is the place of kind of truth and good values, and the city is the place of corruption. But in Roberson's way of thinking, there is no outside of nature. We are, everything human is part of nature. Everything humans have created is part of nature. The city is part of nature. In fact, one of the poems very early in this volume begins talking about how trees are planted and kind of challenging the romanticized vision that trees have to be planted by seeds that flutter to the ground and saying that it's just as natural a way to have trees planted if they're planted by a city urban crew that is planting bald root saplings, you know, with shovels. But this particular poem that I think I'll read you a little bit from is called The Open, and it is about the destruction of an urban neighborhood in order to make way for new highway to help commuters. And the kind of interest, one of the interesting things about this poem is that it makes us rethink a value that we commonly associate with American nature writing, I think, which is that open spaces are spaces of undisturbed nature and great human challenge and potential. I was thinking about The Myths of the Frontier, for instance, in American literature. And this is a poem called The Open, which points out how differently the open may be functioning for an African-American community. In this case, the creation of open space is the destruction of this community. So it begins with the phrase, their buildings razed. That's R-A-Z-E-D, not R-A-I-S-E-D. So their buildings torn down. So I'll read a little bit of this. He uses a lot of syntactic ambiguity. That is, you come to the end of a line and it might suggest one thing and you go to the next line and it can suggest another. So it's a very open and generative kind of work. He also calls upon echoes of African-American vernacular as he writes. So here we go. The open. Their buildings raised, they ghosts, their color that haze of plaster dust, their blocks of bulldozed air opened to light. Take your breath as much by this kind of blinding choke as by the loss felt in the openness. Suddenly able to see, as if across a drained lake from below, a missing surface. The knowing everyone by some common immersion schooling you, not drowned in exposure, the way the neighborhood, a village packing up and leaving, raises you with the catch out in the open. Suddenly able to see people lived where it weren't open. Now that's a harder poem maybe to grasp on just one reading and me reading out loud, but the juxtaposition between having a community like a sort of school of fish here and then the image of the raised neighborhood being like a drained lake that leaves the fish out in the open where, of course, they can't survive, where they're drowned in exposure. And that's the situation of these people. Their village is destroyed through making it an open space. So it makes us rethink some of our environmental values and how they apply in different contexts.
And what happens when we assume when space is experienced in a particular way, right? And
yes.
how in this poem, it sounds like the power is very much being questioned, who has the power
Absolutely.
To construct space. And it's a very, very
right.
powerful poem.
Yeah, he goes yeah. on mm-hmm. to say, I'll just maybe read the next few lines. A people whose any beginning is dispersed by a vagrant progress, whose any settlement is overturned for the better of a highway through to someone else's possibility.
Right. And I hear gentrification being a phenomenon called into question in that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So thank you for bringing our attention to Ed Roberson's work and some of the other poets that are questioning what assumptions are made in Anthropocene discourse and what person is making these decisions and claims on space, et cetera. And I hope readers of EdgeFX and listeners to the EdgeFX podcast are now interested in picking up some of these collections.
Yes,
and,
I hope so,
yeah,
too.
And looking into your book, which really explores a lot and such a variety of texts so lucidly and so compellingly. As a final question, just I'm curious who you're following right now and where your work is taking you.
Sure. Well, right now I'm thinking more about writing about poets interacting with plants and plant lives. I've just been writing recently about a very interesting and curious book by someone named Wendy Burke called Tree Talks, Southern Arizona, where she, quote, interviews trees, individual tree specimens, but does this in a very knowing way and raises a lot of questions about our interactions with our assumptions about understanding plant life, in this case, trees. So I'm reading about Michael Martyr, plant thinking, and there's a lot being done now about plant studies and thinking about how poets are interacting with that. I'm eager to read. I have a long list of books I want to read, and I know Brenda Hillman has a new book out called Extra Hidden Life Among the Days, and she has a series of poems about lichens, which aren't exactly plants, but are maybe part of these less explored life forms that I'm interested in considering through the poets who engage me.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll link to those authors as well. And thank you for joining us today, Lynn.
Thanks,
it's been
so
wonderful.
Much. Mm-hmm.
That was Sarah Thomas, PhD student in literary studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and member of the EdgeFX editorial board, speaking with Lynn Keller, the Martha Mayer Rank Bascom Professor of Poetry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Director of the Center for Culture, History, and Environment. You can learn more about the environmental poets and poetics that Lynn Keller covers in her recently published book, Recomposing Ecopoetics, at her website, lynnkeller.info. You've been listening to EdgeFX, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by Brian Hamilton, Sarah Thomas, and me, Laura Perry, with thanks to WSUM 91.7 FM, Madison. The music you're listening to is by Julian Lynch. Stay tuned for more podcast episodes in the coming weeks. You can get all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review. That really helps connect us with new listeners. You can also follow us on Twitter at EdgeFXMag. And as always, keep up with the steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgefx.net.